thought I'd start off with a review.
First, thanks to Nancy for this lovely environment.
I always feel better I can swear in somebody's house better than I can in the church.
And there's been a fair amount of swearing in here, so it'll just add to the ambiance.
How did I feel that?
There's three boys here, so.
Well, I'll do a quick summary of last week, then kind of tell you what we'll be doing this week, and then looking ahead a little bit. Last week, we talked about aurora consciousness. Somebody asked me, by the way, what does that mean? It means rising dawn. Aurora is dawn, and consciousness is rising. We'll see that's one of the attributes of Sophia, but that will be something we'll do down the road. We talked about who possibly had these visions, and it's von Franz's possible contention, that the visions of St. Thomas Aquinas on his deathbed. If it's not St. Thomas Aquinas, it's certainly somebody like St. Thomas Aquinas. So we went through the life and times of Aquinas last time, basically to give you an idea of his spiritual intellectual nature. And as probably the epitome of scholasticism, he is also representative of that movement. And where that movement fits in the church history is that after the decadence of the Roman era, what Christianity did was introduce a spiritual principle in opposition to the instinctual principle that was dominating late antiquity. This is what Jung takes up an eye on.
When you're saying that was introduced?
Well, basically all of Christianity is a spiritual reaction against the instinctual decadence of late antiquity, namely, you know, Rome. Mm-hmm. Things were just getting out of control. People were just, we were going to burn ourselves up in desire and greed, actually not unlike today. Mm-hmm. But there are certain differences. Anyway, Christianity came in with this discipline, spirituality, rigorous intellectual understanding as it evolved eventually into scholasticism, all those parts of life that aren't instinctual. And as far as Jung's concerned, that was a real contribution of Christianity to Western civilization. But, and I'll hold that but for a second, St. Thomas is just a classic example of that non-physical, non-instinctual spirituality. Or if it wasn't St. Thomas, somebody living in that period was heir to that spiritualization of human nature, which had a valid historical function, but on the other hand, is very one-sided, because it's as much to the spirit as the Roman era was to the instincts. And we are now living at the end of the usefulness of that spiritual principle. Scholasticism was disciplined. It was rigorous. It was mental. And as far as Jung was concerned, it laid the foundations for science. All those values, which we find in scholasticism, when secularized, simply became science. So even though we're not scholastics, we are still living in the rationality of that worldview, which started, around 1100, 1000 AD, 1100. And Thomas, then being representative of that one-sidedness, had in his unconscious all those things that human nature wanted to bring into our civilization to balance us out. So that's why these visions are so important, even though they are 800 years old. They are very modern in a way, because we're still living in the effects of Christendom from the time of the birth of Christ, although we don't necessarily see it as spirituality. We see it as science, but it's the same thing. It's the same rigorous mental grasping of reality. So by going back to this time, whether it's Thomas or whether it's somebody of Thomas that is infected by the same era, doesn't really matter. Because what we're going to see is all those elements in the human psyche, which we so desperately need today, as they needed them then. So that's what we did under the life and times of Thomas. I mentioned very briefly what the book is about, and then we'll come back to it later. Just to recap, the first five chapters of the book are going to be the appearance of this feminine side of the psyche, this feminine archetype, if you will, Sophia. Because Christianity and Christendom was so masculinized, it represents the balancing, she represents, rather, the balancing parts of the psyche to round it out. That's the first five chapters of the book. And as you'll see today, when you meet wisdom, she just doesn't waltz in with a nice, calm demeanor telling you how you should live your life. Generally, you meet this experience in an enormous emotional catastrophe. So the next seven books of Auroric Insurgence are what the poor guy who had these visions had to go through in order to begin to come to terms with that experience of Sophia. So the first five chapters are the presentation of Sophia. The next seven chapters are an attempts at integration of Sophia. We'll have to judge whether he succeeds or not. And of course, then it is our challenge today. What we'll see then in the attempts to come to grips with Sophia is that it's an alchemical process. So we'll also be looking at alchemical symbolism as the Sophia element tried to be integrated into the lifestyle of whoever had these visions. So this course is not only a course on Sophia, it's also be dealing with the alchemical process. Then we got off on looking at Sophia as a concept. Wisdom is a concept. That's where we left off, and that's where we'll pick up today. We'll probably take at least another hour to get through the trying to understand conceptually what is Sophia. Then to ground this so that you have some feeling of its relevance to the actual therapeutic work, I brought along at least an hour, maybe more, I brought along 10 dreams that show Sophia. So then we'll kind of put a little parenthesis there and look at some Sophia dreams so you can get a feeling, what's it look like in somebody's dreams when somebody today has the experiences of Sophia that we're talking about. As I mentioned, so these dreams, these archetypes, generally don't knock on your door and say, hi, I'm the Sophia archetype. They come hidden. But actually, I have to call myself a liar because I got one where really the dreamer does knock on the door and say, hi, I'm Sophia. It's not quite that obvious, but it's pretty obvious. So anywhere from the sublime to the obvious, I want to try to attune you to what kind of dreams we're talking about. Okay, a very brief recap of what we said conceptually about Sophia. And on the study guide, we are on page 34. I talked about Sophia referring to one of her epithets in the book as being symbolized very frequently in dreams by starlight. So Sophia is a pattern. And as stars have been from time immemorial associated with fate, so we can see Sophia is representative of the inborn pattern of our being, of our inborn identity. Sophia is as starlight, as again, we'll get to this eventually. This is on page 210 of the book, but just anticipating the book. As starlight, she's not just a knowledge, she's a knowing. Remember, light is a metaphor for consciousness. So it is another something, put that in quotes, another something in you who knows who you are. And that something who knows who you are is trying to get in touch with us. And she is, she appears in a feminine guise. Why feminine? Because we've been masculinized for so long. So I very briefly, very coarsely, and please remember, we're going to spend the whole time here refining this understanding and looking at this, all the various images that the text throws up to symbolize this. But basically, I called Sophia a knowing of the pattern of your destiny, a knowing of the pattern of your fate. Knowing who you were born to be would be another way to put it. A typical symbol of Sophia, or a starting point for our examining the nature of reality that Sophia is a part of, we talked about in terms of the dual mandala. Remember, mandalas were images of meditation of on the unity of the world. But the irony, if you look at the history of religious symbolism, is often mandalas that are supposed to represent a unity are dual. Why? Because complete living as a whole being, means living on two planes at the same time. The plane of time and space, and this other plane which we have hypothesized, in which, so to speak, this knowledge resides. It appears, if you just look at daily events, there really is no pattern to daily events, that things look chaotic. Where in the world are you supposed to get clues to your real identity by looking at all the mess that you do to yourself from 9 to 5? But if you know how to read the dreams, you begin to realize that beyond this dimension, in whatever way you want to frame it, there is also another place, let's call it, where this knowledge resides. And Jung just gives that a word and calls it the transcendental dimension. He also calls it the transcendental continuum, because by transcendental he means like other than, transcendent to this world, other than this world. In this place, your story is actually one whole piece. That's why he calls it a continuum, transcendental continuum. Life here may be fragmented, but in your essential nature, there is one coherent story that wants to be lived in time and space. And so that transcendental dimension holds the unity of your life, which is trying to bring you into a unity through all the particular twists and turns of your own personal fate. Another word which we introduced, which is actually taken from medieval philosophy, is the unus mundus, U-N-U-S, M-U-N-D-U-S. We'll be talking about that word a lot. That just means one world. The unus mundus is that unity of your potential life. Unfortunately, he uses the word in a couple of different ways. We'll see at certain moments, in this apparently random series of events of our life. Carol just brought me one. Nelson Mandela, I guess, in prison, put his hand and made a handprint as a work of art. And when he pulled it away, the palm of his hand had left the imprint of the country of Africa, the continent of Africa. We notice at certain... I'll pass it around if you like. We notice at certain moments the events in our dreams, as we try to get to know this real person in us, and we begin to get pieces of it through our dreams. The events in dreams also occur in reality. This is what Jung calls a synchronicity. I'm presuming you all know that term. I told you the Pegasus example, I think. Did I tell you the Pegasus example? A friend of mine's in a writing program on the West Coast, and she's having difficulty getting her big major paper in. And she's calling us, I'm going to fail. And so I said, there's a myth for this situation. We weren't talking about dreams. This is just a friendship. I said, there's a myth for this situation that is described in the myth of Perseus and Medusa. And Medusa represents all those negative thoughts that assault us. That's why she's got snakes here. That's the poisonous thinking that we say, I can't, I'm going to fail, all that sort of thing. And what Perseus does, he comes in and he lops her head off, which means we have to have the masculine strength to denude those negative voices of their strength. And when he chops off the head, didn't I tell you this? No. That's why you told your group. Okay.
The other
alchemy group.
Yeah.
When he chops off her head, out springs Pegasus. And Pegasus, when Pegasus' foot hits the ground, gives birth to the spring of the Muses. So you can see right in that myth that this is the birth of creativity. Real creativity starts when you are wrestling with these negative voices and you're able to chop them down, what will come out of it is an inspiration, and that inspiration is the birth of your creativity. And she said, oh, maybe I'm not crazy. I said, hey, you see, you're not crazy. You're just creative. Very close, but not quite the same. So she finished her paper, and I got a call at 2:30 one morning. Hi, guess what? I said, guess what? It's 2:30 in the morning. I know, but it's 11:30 here. I just have to call you and tell you. I finally got that paper done. I'm at my teacher's office, and which had an office in town, and I just turned it in. Thank you for your help. That really got me through it. Silence. Oh, my God. What? Oh, my God. Yeah? A truck just drove by, and lettered on the side was the word Pegasus. That's synchronicity. When the outer event corresponds to the inner plan. So Unus Mundus has two meanings. It has the meaning of your inner whole life story, which is a coherent, meaningful unfolding. It also has the meaning of when pieces of that story drop down into reality so that it no longer seems to be a split between inner and outer. So he uses the word in two ways. You can think of it as the wholeness of your inner story, or you can think of it as the unity of inner and outer when this transcendental dimension actually becomes real. All of this, then, you see, is in the area of Sophia. Sophia is that plan. Sophia is that moment when the transcendental world becomes actual. And you are no longer thwarted by reality, but you're guided by reality. Another way to say that is that Sophia has to do with the unity of matter and spirit. See, in that synchronistic moment, the non-material world of her hopes and dreams and the images which gave expression to them were an occurrence in the material world. So the spiritual and the material, at these moments of the one world, of the Unus Mundus, in these synchronistic moments, in these moments when the Sophia plan is making itself known in time and space, that split between matter and spirit is annihilated. Is annihilated. There is no more split. There is no more me as a subject looking at the world as an object. The world is as subjective as I am, because it loses its impersonal character and it participates in the unfolding of my own personal life. That, by the way, contradicts every assumption of Western science and Western civilization. I gave a workshop up at Wild Oats. You were there. Well, though, it's last week, and I presented this, and some guy said, well, that goes in the face of everything that Western science has said, and you're not going to find many people who agree with you. And I said, well, that's science's problem, not our experience's problem. But you see how we identify with the paradigm, and we let the paradigm define our experience rather than stay with the experience. And what this whole work on Sophia is about is going back to our experience, putting aside all assumptions about the nature of reality, and trying to reconstruct a worldview based on these facts. You noticed the emotion in the room when I told you that story. If you're going to take emotions seriously, you have to take these facts seriously. And that's what first Jung, Pauli, and now Hirwan Franz are attempting to do in their looking at Sophia.
And don't you think most people that aren't into this kind of think the way he does, though? Mm. I mean, when I first went into Mary Curtis's, the first time Dream Group, and I heard Mary Curtis talk about, you know, foretelling the future, that type of thing, I thought to myself, well, I know she's an intelligent woman. She couldn't really have said that. But my reaction was the very same, and boy, did I learn different. But, I mean, you just have to learn, you know.
I don't think you really can understand it until you've had it affect your life.
Exactly.
And usually, you've heard my story about Barbara Streisand. Anyone's heard my Barbara Streisand? My first synchronicity. I was in training in Zurich, and those of you who heard this, bear with me. I was in training in Zurich, and I picked the world's worst Jungian analyst to start out with. I stayed with the guy for a year. He almost killed me, which was, in retrospect, a good lesson, because now I know what a bad analyst is. At the time, I didn't feel it was such a fortunate experience. And I had gone there with my girlfriend. We split up. The dollar dropped. I was broke. Everything was going wrong. And so I went in, and I was really sad, and I was telling him in true negative mother fashion, which was his problem. He said, well, you see, you're so self-centered. You can't deal with loss, and you're so needy, and just sort of tore me apart for the despair I was going through. So I walked out, of course, believing all the things he said. And I went home and lay down on my bed and flipped on the radio. Now, mind you, this is a Swiss radio station. Flipped on the radio. Barbra Streisand was singing, "People Who Need People Are the Luckiest People in the World." So those sort of events happen when you are really confused, and they come along in a way to bolster you. And they come along to bolster you and guide you on this real path of your life. So they have a very strong emotional pull to them.
Is this changing worldview? Is this something that's just episodic, or can actually a worldview be constructed in which the perceiving entity can reside in that space?
No, I think it's the answer to that question depends on the future of the world depends on the answer to that question. we won't get into it in this course so much, but probably the next thing I'm going to think about doing. I told you a little bit about Wolfgang Pauli, the physicist who helped discover quantum physics, went to Jung right after, that was in 1930, roughly. He kind of fell apart, went to see Jung, got himself back on his feet, and they had a loose relationship until 1944. Pauli, being half-Jewish, had an Austrian citizenship. He was Austrian, and was in danger if the Nazis would have come into Switzerland. So he got out of Switzerland and came to Princeton and worked with Einstein for a year. And then when the bomb went off, got horrendously depressed, even though he didn't have any direct input to the bomb. He was the only physicist who actually refused to work on it. He got really depressed, went back to Jung, and basically said to his unconscious, what has gone wrong? How did my beloved science contribute to now the possibility of the world's annihilation? And help me, he said to his dreams, help me understand, what do we need to understand to stop this? Can you imagine what he dreamt of for the next 15 years? Sophia. Those dreams had just been published. So if we take that man's dreams, who was really at the heart, I mean, you know, he was best friends with Oppenheimer, Einstein, Teller, all these guys who made the bomb. He was right at the heart of it, even though he didn't participate in making it. He was certainly had his finger on the pulse beat of history. That's what his unconscious said. If science can come to grips with Sophia, we will survive. If science cannot come to grips with Sophia, we will not survive. And the way I kind of liken it is, you know, put yourself back at the time when we still thought that the Earth was the center of the solar system. And then imagine trying to explain to somebody at that time what the quantum is. I think we're in a similar position, that we are now in the position of a very limited consciousness. We don't know how our consciousness will evolve in the future. But if we can take Pauli's dreams as an example, and this is what he was trying to understand, although I don't think we yet can understand it. This is the direction science will move. Somehow, taking account of the non-rational. I don't want to get us too off track on that point. But I think this is not just, this is, of course, a beautiful story in itself. It's very useful to therapy, but I think also it's very important to the survival of our world. And the presence in his dreams, and his and Jung's attempt to understand it. They both knew they couldn't get the answer, but they just got together to try to figure out, what are the questions? How is our scientific worldview, or how is our general worldview to develop in the next 500 years? It developed in the last 500 years. Why won't it develop in the next 500 years? And I think we probably see in these guys' materials the attempts of the psyche now to create a new understanding. Will we do it? I don't know. How long will it take? I don't know. But it does seem to be the psychological challenge put to us, if you take his dreams as a paradigm. That's why I find this stuff so important and exciting, Bo. And stay tuned. Maybe we'll do a seminar on those dreams one of these days there. They're in German, and I'm going to try to translate them into English. Okay, that brings us up to the end of last class. Now, For those of you who are new to this thing, I warn you, we go through this text, some of these texts, sentence by sentence, because I think if you've tried to read Aurora, and Number and Time is about the same level of difficulty, you're going to find that it's difficult material. And I'm still now working with Number and Time. And Number and Time is von Franz's attempt to understand these experiences that Sophia symbolized from her thoughts. So that's what I'm doing now, is going through some of those thoughts, that we can get a conceptual grasp of Sophia, and then we can look at her in dreams and then in images. So if you go over to page 35, I want to read you that last full paragraph. Again, remember, we're looking at attempts to understand through thought who Sophia is. The unconscious actually appears to contain a kind of knowledge which is not identical with ego consciousness. In his paper on the nature of the psyche, now we're going to look at that paper in detail, but just to mention it now, Jung took great pains to demonstrate that the archetypes of the unconscious possess a kind of quasi-intelligence which is not the same as our ego consciousness. Now, what's an archetype? Let's go through this very carefully. What's an archetype?
Primal pattern.
Right. It's a primal pattern, and we naively think of the archetype as something in ourselves which helps shape our dreams. For Jung, the archetype is that patterning which lies behind images in dreams having similar meanings. Does that make sense? If it doesn't, holler.
So, say it again.
So it's the opposite of a personal meaning, in a way. It's a general meaning, as opposed to a personal meaning.
Yeah, hold that. We'll come back to that. Because it speaks to you personally, but it's a general meaning. Should I give you an example?
Personal manifestation.
Yeah. See, what is so hard about understanding this stuff is that Jung makes himself very simple when he tries to define these things. And he's asking himself, how is it that dream images can mean anything at all? How is it that they mean something in the first place? Well, the reason they can mean something in the first place is that there's something in us making them meaningful. That's what he calls an archetype. Now, it goes on from there a little bit. In addition to this factor which makes dream images meaningful, it looks like under similar circumstances, we dream of similar images. Take that synchronicity I talked about, where I said to her that Pegasus represented creativity. Why is it that Pegasus represents creativity? Because there's something in us that makes that horse image when the issue is creativity. And that is not, we can't explain how or why that happens. It just happens. That's Jung's starting place. And similarly, two people facing the same issue of creativity are likely to have dreams of Pegasus. These images appear in typical circumstances. See, why was it that I told her about Pegasus and then a Pegasus truck drove by? Because Pegasus is an image used by the unconscious to express what creativity is. And that's just a given. That's an archetype. So the first, is that better or not? Okay.
I mean, would any flying horse be Pegasus, or would it have to be a, I mean, you have to have the name
Lord
Pegasus?
No, no. These things are very subtle. What you will do is look at the context. And the context will very often be that there's a nasty woman and then a flying horse. Now, I'm simplifying a little bit, but for the sake of illustration. These two things go together. So you look at the commonality of the variety of the images associated with that archetypal image. They generally occur in patterns. Is that making it better or worse? Okay. Now, you can understand a little bit, I think, that there is an intelligence implied. Something in us knows to throw up that horse image when the issue is creativity. Something in you knows to throw up the hero image when you're fighting a battle and you're feeling stuck. Something in you knows to throw up a rose in your dream when the issue is love. Well, all Jung is doing is taking these assumptions that we have and just making himself very simple and saying, why is that so? Well, the reason it's so is because there's something in there making it so. And he gives that something a word. That's the archetype. But it's more complicated because those images don't only occur on the inside of us. Do I need to give you any more examples, or are you happy with, have I established the fact? More examples?
No.
You're okay. Okay.
A lot of people would, you know, come up with would be, gee, why would your unconscious archetype pick a horse, winged horse, as the image for a creativity? Why not, you know, apple tree, or why not something else? Why that particular image? I can see that would be the common question.
There is no answer to that. I mean, you can, the only answer you can give in philosophy, they would call begging the question. You answer the question with another question. The answer would be, well, because ever since Greek myth, that winged horse has represented creativity. That doesn't answer, why did the Greeks choose that image to represent? There is no answer. I want to be a little careful here. This isn't hard and fast. Just because you see it, you can't say, oh, that's what it means. You have to look at the whole context. But there are, it might be fairer to say probabilities of meaning. There's a likelihood this is what it's going to mean. Like you have an apple tree. Well, chances are that is not going to be about creativity. That's going to be about Adam and Eve, you see? Eros. So, different images tend to have different meanings, but when they appear, they tend to mean, within a general frame, a certain range of possibility only. You can certainly have a winged horse that means something other than creativity, and you can have a tree that can mean something else. But he's looking at, on the whole, there seems to be this tendency for things to mean certain things. That's an archetype. That what really got him stumped is that he started out giving a psychological analysis. That this factor in you makes your dreams, shapes your dream images. But if we know that synchronicities also repeat dream images, then this archetype must not only exist within us. It must therefore also exist without us. Now, that's as far as he took it. He only saw the implications of this theory. He gave him a word. He said that the archetype is psychoid, which means psychological-like. It is not merely psychological. Somehow, in a way we don't understand, it is not only part of our psyche, it's also part of the material world. Otherwise, the material world couldn't act like a dream. That, again, is Sophia. Sophia is the presence of that intelligence in the material world. Again, we're just circumambulating. We're going to be looking at several definitions of her to try to, because she's something you just really can't pin down. But I'm trying to give you different aspects, different ways of expressing what she is. And that's one way of expressing what Sophia represents. That, whatever was involved with that truck driving by, just at the moment that young woman needed to hear from the world that she is on the right track, that damn truck was there. Whatever is behind that is an intelligence, Jung is saying. And that intelligence, one way to describe that intelligence is it's Sophia. It's the intelligence within the otherwise chaotic flow of daily events, such that at some moments the material world does not seem random anymore.
Mm-hmm. The implication of God, i.e. spirit, in that?
Well, as we'll see, Sophia is an aspect of God. And we'll hold that question for you, because we'll try to look at what are the different dimensions of God. And what dimension is Sophia? And why are we emphasizing her now as opposed to the other dimensions? And we'll also probably have to get to that word spirit, too, eventually. So, Jung took great pains to demonstrate that the archetypes of the unconscious possess a kind of quasi-intelligence. Hopefully that word now should be sensible. Quasi-intelligence in the fact that the unconscious meaningfully throws up images at certain moments which mean similar things, as if to say it knows what it's doing. And it is not something we consciously do. It happens. So it's not the same as our ego consciousness. Jung applied the term luminosity to this consciousness of the archetypes in order to differentiate it from the light of ego consciousness. Now comes the biggie. The same phenomenon can be observed from another angle when a synchronistic occurrence takes place. Inner and outer facts then behave as if their meaningful relation were in some way known, but not to our personal consciousness. Does that make sense? It's as if that truck, I have to say as if, but it's as if that truck knew to drive by at that time. He's not wanting to make it so black and white, but he's wanting to know that that physical world does act intelligently, apparently intelligently, at certain moments. Differently expressed, a meaning manifests itself in synchronistic phenomena which appears to be independent of consciousness and to be completely transcendental. Is that sentence okay?
Can we substitute coherence for meaning? Is that word too semantically?
No, it's very close. Meaning would be when, again, you have to always remember his starting point, that there is an a priori identity in us. And meaning would be when what we are living here in time and space is a sequential unfolding of that a priori identity. So you really, in Jung's mind, you can't define the word meaning without reference to that other dimension. So meaning is the fulfilling of that plan. And you can see from that, maybe that's what we're trying to do in therapy. We're trying to help people live on this earth what they are meant to live. And I think that story often does contain a mixture of victory and defeat. So it's interesting to watch folks who are going through a tough time when they see how that tough time is part of their story. It takes the sting out of it. Because what really drives us crazy isn't misery, it's meaninglessness. It's when we don't see that what we're going through has any relationship to anything else. Those of you who have done more than one of these courses, the true masochists in the group, you may have heard me mention a word in there, has no relationship to your deeper self, your deeper meaning. We see relationship as eros. So we're talking here about a type of eros, but don't worry about that if you're new. We will eventually look at the nature, how this got Jung to re-examine what love is.
I think what's really interesting is to think that truck could have gone by and didn't have any meaning for her.
Ah, hold that thought. Because it comes up next. It's very, very important. Yeah, let's suppose she hadn't seen that truck. What then?
Or she saw it and somehow nothing registered.
Or she saw it and nothing registered.
Right.
Yeah.
But the fact that she was talking to you on the phone, and you were the one who had just told her that story, I mean, mm-hmm. all of those components
all came together.
Which makes us wonder how much we miss every day.
That's my thought, too.
I mean, we can spend our whole lives like looking around going, okay, well,
it's all around us.
Right, and that's the consciousness that we aren't quite living in yet.
Well, see, I don't think, as I understand this, it often, sometimes life is just a pile of crap.
I see, okay.
It's just shit, but it all comes down to it.
Absolutely.
Well, somehow that's kind of comforting in a way, too.
Well, yes, exactly. Occasionally it's just, what it is.
Yeah.
Wade through it. Nothing that a good curse word won't take care of.
That's why we need to swear. But there are moments when something happens that what looks like crap is highly meaningful. And I can tell you, just back to my own little story of that stupid therapist, I am now so thankful for that experience that I know what shitty therapy is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A lot of crap is good fertilizer.
If it doesn't sink your boat.
You have to get a lot of life here. So you're saying you think that a lot of the crap that goes on is just crap and only some of it is related and has some sort of profound meaning.
That's what I'm inclined to say.
I was kind of thinking more and more the other way. Maybe I'm getting real idealistic.
Well, I don't want to pop any balloons here, but I think there are two dangers. You know, there's a danger of cynicism, which says nothing is meaningful, and then there's the New Age danger, which says everything is meaningful.
That's a good point.
And I don't say you can say Auschwitz was meaningful. That's the limit, you see. Mm-hmm. It could be that as we mature, we are more aware, receptive to the meaningful moments. I don't know. But in any case, you have to reach your own personal conclusion here. My feeling is sometimes, you just, like with the book of Job, you just have to know what is wrong and say, this is wrong, and I'm fighting it. I don't care what any authority says. I don't care what the divine is doing here. I don't agree with this. And there are also times when you have to step back and shut up and listen. And it's a very delicate balance. This work is in the service of helping us step back and listen and assess.
Oh, free will.
And we'll see very much that Sophia is in the service of free will. But let's go on. Nancy, you raised a very important point. Yes? Oh, you raised a very important point, which she raises shortly. So let's go on there. We're talking about the archetype, it. It consists of representational images, and its appearance seems to be connected with the momentary activation of an archetype, manifesting itself simultaneously in physical and psychic realms in the form of a causal ordinance. So that should be okay, right? The archetype, that Pegasus, was in her mind, and it was in reality, and that's the archetype of creativity expressed through the image of the horse, as it existed in her, as an existent reality, and existed at two places, and the same image-producing factor produced both. In matter, and when we say spirit, here we mean mind. We'll be using spirit in a couple of different ways.
The critical thing is the image was in her mind, because that she could have studied that truck when it drove by, and if that hadn't been in her mind previously, it wouldn't have meant anything to her.
Exactly.
She was looking at the track of Pegasus. I remember that. We'd come up even as a kid, but it wouldn't have
had
any meaning to it.
Yeah. Well, hang on, because you're both raising the point she's coming to. The media that unites these inner and outer happenings consists of knowledge. And let's see, this again flies in the face of all contemporary philosophy. Consists of a knowledge unmediated by the sense organs. In other words, what Jung is asking, I hate to say he's saying, because he's just questioning these things, trying to formulate this stuff. If I say that there is a knowledge in me that generates that dream image when I need it, then I have to say there's a knowledge in that event that generates that event whether I know it or not. So apparently knowledge is not limited to our understanding of things. There is also a knowledge out there knowing what needs to be done for us. That's the implication.
It's like saying that all inventions exist before they're invented.
I don't know if it's saying that or not. It's similar. It is saying that knowledge is something apart from knowers. That is for sure. And that knowledge adheres to events just like it adheres to images. This is what Jung calls absolute knowledge. You'll hear that phrase a lot in later Jung. Absolute knowledge. Since it seems to be detached from our consciousness. Now comes my favorite sentence. In other words, although the initial significance of a synchronistic event can only be experienced subjectively, okay, the fact of a meaningful coincidence on psychic and physical level suggests that the meaning may also have been originally present in the objective event itself. So whether she saw it or not, there was a meaning in that event, he is suggesting. Something rational or similar to meaning may inhere in the event itself.
So it didn't really matter if she saw the vehicle or not.
Well, it did for her own development.
But the content, the meaning, was resonant there anyway.
But it's an affirmation that she saw it, kind of an affirmation.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't think she would. She was in great doubt at that time whether she was in the right course of study. And that gave her a confirmation. And it's very interesting, those of you who have been raised by lousy mothers. See, what that lousy mother never does to a child is affirm that child that they're doing the right thing. Oh, you're walking, that's good. Oh, you're pooping, that's good. Oh, you're doing your homework, that's good. What a beautiful drawing. See, most of us grow up with this inner ability to feel good when we do the right thing. And my friend had a horrible mother. Her therapist met the mother and said, she's the most narcissistic woman I've ever met, and I've been doing this work for 30 years. But you see, so the universe, however, takes the place of that mother. We'll be talking about that too. How is it that parental wounds can get healed in these impersonal experiences? And see, that gave her great confidence that somebody cared. She has had a lifetime of feeling nobody cares whether I do it right or not. And so that had an enormous emotional impact for her. It wasn't just a cognitive recognition of this cute event. It was this deeply felt, thank God, something makes sense on this planet. That is why we're talking about Sophia in the area of emotions. Because meaning and emotion, as we will see, will belong together. And again, another word for Sophia would be this absolute knowledge. This hypothesized knowledge on the part of events to operate in a way that moves us forward. that paragraph there, which we just read, I think is probably the single most helpful paragraph for conceptually understanding Sophia. The meaning may have been originally present in the objective event itself. See, that is a fundamentally new idea, and it is fundamentally in conflict with all of Western philosophy and science.
She brought up sort of in one of the conversations, and it was about the sort of the hermetic sensibility of as above, so below, as within, so without. Is this not a reflection of that pre-scientific notion?
Right. Exactly. That's the alchemical dictum, and some way we've got to get back to that in a way that is also consistent with our empirical methodology. And that also Pauli was very interested in. He went back and wrote a paper on the point where, and we'll say science throughout alchemy, around, 1750 probably. Isaac Newton, remember, was an alchemist too. So at one point, those two worldviews could exist side by side, but now it's you get laughed out of any science class if you talk like this.
Like we're a little band of.
Yeah, we would have been burned at the stake over just having this, maybe 3 centuries ago.
But having said that, some of you heard this story too. I've got to try to track this tape down. I found it once on the internet, and I think I have bookmarked it. They did a research at Stanford Research Institute about 20 years ago, and they have mediums who they can control, who can control the decay rate of uranium. They put it behind lead, everything, and sure, in these meetings, they go into a trance and they can affect the decay rate. And, I mean, it's documented. And so they, it was a NOVA program, and so they took it on the road and they discussed it with a theologian. Oh, it couldn't happen. You know, God's sovereign laws, blah, blah, blah. And the psychologist, well, that's a narcissistic inflation. And all sorts of people who denigrated it. It's fact. And they then took it to a physicist, a real science. He said, well, obviously, it's a fact. Science is wrong. It's been wrong before, and it's wrong now, because we see it can't explain these very facts. And science has always grown by trying to take account of what is unexplainable. And I think what Jung and Pauli are trying to do in Here von Franz is look at this other dimension of our experience, not to tear down anything we've ever accomplished, but to say, here's the next thing we have to take account of. So I don't really see it in conflict with anything.
And there are more and more people coming in tune with this.
Absolutely.
I'm so beautiful as a work of resonance. You know, I mean, the kind of,
right.
You know, we get it, individuals seem to kind of spread out. People kind of are all tuning in little by little.
My husband's an organic chemist, and even he is getting little breakthroughs. Quite exciting. It's scary, though, because it shifts his world in a way that doesn't shift mine, because I'm not from that mindset. So, I mean, there's a lot of compassion that has to go along with this as we try to stay in marriages.